Welcome to New Books in Biography. I'm Oline Eden. Diana Vreeland had an extraordinary impact on fashion during the middle of the last century. She was resilient, imaginative, and in an incredibly fickle industry, she produced groundbreaking work for over 40 years. Today I'm going to be discussing her life with Amanda Mackenzie Stewart, author of the book Diana Vreeland, Empress of Fashion. Hi, Amanda. Thank you so much for joining us for New Books in Biography today. I wonder if you could just kick things off by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm a writer based in Oxford in England. For many years, I worked in the film business. I went to the National Film and Television School. And so I had many years working as part of the independent production film industry in the UK. And then about 10 years ago, a story that I thought might be a film story turned into a biography of Consuelo Vanderbilt and her mother. And after that, since then, I focused really almost entirely on biography.
What drew you to Diana Vreeland as a subject?
Well, really, it was a question of one thing leading to another. Diana Vreeland popped up unexpectedly at the very end of my biography about Consuelo Vanderbilt. Diana Vreeland put Consuelo Balfon, as she was then called, into an exhibition called American Women of Style in 1976. Put her clothes, because by that time Consuelo was dead, but put her clothes and some images of her into this exhibition called American Women of Style. And instead of being a paragraph, you know, and just me sort of kind of running through this quite quickly at the end of this biography of Consuelo, I got totally distracted by this great character, Diana Vreeland, about whom I actually knew very little at that point. And really, that's how it began. You know, the subject for my second book was kind of born in front of my eyes as a result of writing the first one.
What sources were most helpful to you?
Sorry, could you repeat that?
Of course. What sources were most helpful to you?
I'm sorry, I still didn't get that one.
What sources were most helpful to you?
Sources were helpful? Well, most of the sources were in New York. The key source was the Diana Vreeland papers, which were in the New York Public Library in the manuscript room. So they were deposited there after her death by her grandchildren. They were a very important source. Another crucial source were the magazines that she worked on through the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. The back numbers of Harper's Bazaar were crucial. Back numbers of American Vogue were absolutely essential sources. And then, of course, it was also a question of interviewing many people who couldn't still remember her. Mm-hmm. So I had to talk to many people. It was a great pleasure tracking them down and talking to them. So really, that's how the sources divided: papers, magazines, and interviews. So I have to say, I had quite a lot of trouble persuading my friends and family that spending days on end flicking through back numbers of Harper's Bazaar and Vogue really added up to work. But it was.
So coming to this book, I had really limited knowledge of Vreeland's early years, but I always assumed she was European and spent most of her life in France. This ties into this sort of, for lack of a better phrase, origin myths that arose around her childhood. So where did she come from?
Well, she was born in Paris. That is absolutely true. She was the daughter. She was born British. Her father was British, so that made her British at that period. She only took American citizenship much later. So she was born British to a British father and an American mother. But she didn't grow up in Paris, as she often claimed. The family moved back to New York from Europe when she was just a few months old. And though they made many trips to Europe when she was younger, and her parents both thought of themselves, I think, to some extent, as spiritually European, She had a New York upbringing. But the answer to your question about where did the myth come from, the myth came from her. I mean, she just liked to rewrite her own childhood and say that she was essentially brought up in Paris and that, you know, in a world where, you know, Nijinsky came to the house and the great demi mondaine of the Belle Époque swished past her in the Bois de Boulogne and so on. But it wasn't really true. It wasn't true at all. And I became very interested in why she chose to tell the story of her own childhood in this way, because I think there were quite interesting reasons for it. Shall I go on and say why?
Yes. What were those reasons?
Well, I think she really did have a very unhappy childhood. What was definitely true was that she was a rather plain child born into a family of beauties. She had a very beautiful mother, was renowned for her beauty, a very good-looking father, and a very, very beautiful younger sister. Her younger sister looked like a mother, and little Deanna looked like her father. And this seemed to cause, in this particular family, which was really a slightly dysfunctional family, a great deal of pain. I mean, she felt from a very young age that her mother was ashamed of her because of the way she looked. And I've no doubt that she was a very difficult and demanding child, because she was always being compared to this very beautiful, very easy and intelligent younger sister. And Deanna was the difficult one, and Alexandra, her younger sister, was the beautiful, intelligent, and I think very nice person. But, you know, life came easier to her, and it didn't for little Deanna. And the problem was compounded by the fact that they had a nanny, a very long-serving nanny, who very much echoed mother's attitude to this daughter. And so she was coping all the time with two adults in the house who really had a terrible down on her, I think. And she, I think, probably became very difficult as a result. She was also, I think, a highly, highly imaginative child, and she learned to take refuge quite early on in a sort of parallel fantasy world. But that also made her very difficult to educate. She liked to claim that she wasn't really ever educated, but the parents, in fact, made sterling efforts to educate her properly at Brearley School in New York. But it didn't work. It really didn't suit her. And when she was around 13, Brearley asked her to leave. And around that time, I think she became very, very depressed. I suspect that adolescence didn't do her looks at that stage any favours. She had no sympathy with her mother's great new hobby, which was big game hunting. She absolutely hated it. She was then really expelled, essentially, from Brearley. And later on, when she was older, she chose to just rewrite this in a much more dashing and interesting way. She rewrote her childhood as much more as she, I think, she would have liked it to have been, rather than the way it was.
You write that as a young person, she tried to find a great person on whom to model herself so that she too could be great, which I found fascinating, because I think that's sometimes why people read biographies, to take kernels of wisdom from other people's lives and incorporate them in their own. Can you talk a bit about how she went about doing this, and if she did find a great person on who to model herself?
Yes, certainly. As she went in, I mean, the evidence we have for the way her mind worked in her early to mid-teens is a diary that she kept when she was 14, and it dates from 1918. And she's clearly continuing to have a very unhappy time. She's left Brearley School. She's already happier because she's doing a lot of dancing classes with a Russian dance teacher called Mr. Shalif in the afternoons. But what we see her do in this diary is constantly switch into this parallel fantasy world where she searches around for a role model on which to base herself. But in the end decides that no one that she meets or no one that she's reading about will really quite do. and that the person on whom she's going to model herself is a best perfect version of herself, which she calls the girl. She says something like, never have I found a girl or a woman to look up to. I shall be that girl. And you can see her working out in the diary how to become her own role model, if you like, by creating this sort of perfect vision of how she could be. And this involves sort of setting about huge effort of self-production in her early teens, in which she decided to attend to every aspect of herself. So this is the way she talked. She tells herself that she's deliberately going to increase her vocabulary. The way she walks, the way she is with her friends, the way she behaves, and, of course, the way she looks. She starts, you can see in the diary, that she's starting to think very hard about changing the way she looks. And in the diary, in this period, you can also see something else happening, which is that this effort of changing the way she presents herself to the world actually works. She starts to have friends for the first time in her life. People find her amusing. You know, you can see that the great thing was not just that this was some sort of fantasy, but that when she actually put the fantasy into action and changed the way the world saw her, her life changed too. And that was very important, I think, for the point of view of her later career.
Mm-hmm. So how did she become involved in fashion?
Her involvement in fashion came much later, when she was in her 30s, and it came, she became interested in fashion because very early, I mean, one can see that she was already turning herself into a very stylish young woman and was known for her style, even as a debutante in New York. So she was passionately interested in clothes because they were such an important tool in this effort of how you presented yourself to the world at that stage. She married Reed Vreeland when she was an incredibly handsome husband when she was very young. And they then spent 6.5 years in Europe and quickly became members of international high society. She was very amusing. He was incredibly handsome. And they were a charming couple. And they met all sorts of people like Cecil Beaton and Elsie Mendel and the great socialite Mona Harrison Williams. And at that stage, when they were actually living in London, Deanna Vreeland started to, as she then became Mrs. Vreeland, then started to go over to Paris to have her clothes fitted and, as it were, imitate and copy some of the great fashionable women with whom she was now associating and becoming friends. And they all did this. They all went to Paris regularly for fittings with the great Paris couture houses. And Deanna found a way of doing this too. She didn't have the money of her very rich friends, but couture at that point was not nearly as expensive as it later became. And she found it absolutely fascinating. I mean, you had to submit in those days, as I'm sure you do now, to a great number of fittings and be available to go back repeatedly and stand for hours while somebody pinned and recut and all, you know, on you. That was often the way it was done. And she particularly patronised the house of Mambochet, but also, when she could afford it, the great Coco Chanel. And so she really learnt, became fascinated by the technique of it as well. So she learnt a great deal about the technique of couture, of dressmaking and fashion at that point in her life. Mm-hmm. So when the Vreelands went back to New York in 1935 because of Reed Vreeland's job, she was already casting around for a way to earn money because she felt that they needed some extra. And at that point, she was talent spotted by an extraordinary person called Carmel Snow, who was the fairly new editor of Harper's Bazaar and just intuited Deanna's talent and offered her a job. Carmel Snow wasn't absolutely certain what to do with Deanna at that point. And in fact, the very first thing she got her to do was a column called Why Don't You?, which was essentially a kind of list of stylish suggestions that covered much more than fashion. But from 1939 onwards, it was clear that what Diana Vreeland really, really, really knew about and had an extraordinary sense of was clothes, and an extraordinary talent for clothes. And from 1939 onwards, she became the fashion editor of Harper's Bazaar.
Okay, we're going to come back to Harper's Bazaar in just a second, but I want to go back to the European period, because in the book you mentioned that it's kind of hard to pin down some of the details of what actually happened. So as a biographer, how do you deal with the discrepancies in how your subject said things happened and how it seems that they actually did? The Josephine Baker story, for instance.
Well, the Josephine Baker story, I think one has to hazard a guess. I mean, I thought it would be a very boring book if I just spent my whole time going through what Diana Vreeland said and what probably happened. Sometimes the gap between the two is rather fascinating. The Josephine Baker story involved going to the cinema, seeing a film called The Leplontide, which involved leopards, putting her hand down on something in the cinema while she was watching leopards on the screen, and finding that her hand rested on Josephine. It wasn't a leopard, it was a cheetah. The film involved cheetahs. The way she told the story was that she put her hand down on something only to discover that her hand was resting on Josephine Baker's cheetah. And in her story, she turned round to Josephine Baker and said, "Oh, I see you've brought your cheetah to see the cheetahs." And that's what Josephine Baker is said to have said, "Yes, that's exactly what I've done." And then Diana Vreeland finishes the story by watching Josephine Baker go out into the street with the cheetah and just jumping into a great big Rolls Royce and going off here. In that particular instance, which was a great story, I looked it all up. Yes, the film, Josephine Baker was in Paris, the same as what was supposed to have taken place in Paris. That was all perfectly plausible. I expect that what happened is that she did see Josephine Baker with her cheetah, but I don't think that it's very likely that the cheetah was in the cinema and was very good right through the film, because the cheetah was a very famously badly behaved cheetah. So another point in Diana Vreeland's life, she said something like, "The last details of any story are never satisfactory." So quite often what you find with her stories is it's the last details, the final details, that she's tweaked up to make a good story and have an impact. But that it all has some basis in something that really probably did happen.
So what was Harper's Bazaar like during her time there, and what were her how did she change the magazine?
Well, Harper's Bazaar was a very extraordinary magazine, even by the time she joined it. Carmel Snow was a remarkable editor with a great instinct for talent, and she'd already appointed an art director called Alexei Brodovich, who was changing the look of this magazine. And in fact, he's said to be the father of graphic design, and you know, his influence can still be felt in the way magazines and advertising are designed and laid out to this day. So there's this extraordinary talent there with Alexei Brodovich, and into this came Diana Vreeland with her particular responsibility, essentially for fashion, The magazine was already going through a process of a real transformation by the time she got there. Her influence can really be seen partly in the, first of all, in the language of the fashion writing, which really was extraordinary. It began to change from descriptions of fabrics and just little captions that ran underneath the photograph, to much more poetic, interesting descriptions of the clothes. So that was one thing. But a lot of the importance of her job was behind the scenes, in the sense that what Carmel Snow wanted her to do was bring European pizzazz to the American fashion industry, so that the clothes that were being produced by the American fashion houses and the American manufacturers were of a sufficiently high standard to be photographed in this new cutting-edge and very brilliant magazine. So actually, what from the outset, Carmel Snow saw Deanna Vreeland's job as a fashion editor to catalyse improvements in American style. And that was sort of built in to the role from the outset. So quite a lot of her work was involved going down to 7th Avenue, seeing the manufacturers, persuading them to do things in a much more interesting way, taking ideas to them, you know, for hats and snoods and accessories and all, and there was a way clothes were cut and you know, a whole new ideas, part of them that she brought over from Europe, and try to get American fashion up to a whole new level. And that, of course, to a very considerable extent, she succeeded. And that began to reflect itself in the way that the magazine, in the fashion pages of the magazine.
One of the really interesting passages to me was during World War II, how she shifted the magazine to meet the needs of women of the time. Can you talk a bit about how its focus changed during the war years?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it is actually a very fascinating period in American fashion history, this. I mean, all the men that were involved, a lot of went off to join the war effort in one way or another, leaving the production of American fashion magazines, and indeed American fashion, to a small group of highly talented women like Claire McArdle and some other women in that circle. The focus changed from, you know, to a much more sort of make do and mend, take what you find around you, whether it's your big brother's overcoat or moccasins and belts, and, you know, put the look together in your own way, but keep your morale up and the morale up of those around you by doing it with style, you know. And so it became much more sort of a much more individualized, empathic approach to fashion in the war years, much less sort of, you know, we tell you how to dress and you do what we say. It's much more we help you put yourself together with the help of these brilliant young American designers who are designing for these wartime lives you are leading. So it was a very, very different approach to fashion to high fashion in the late 1930s. A big, big change, which actually then did rather switch back again to command and control fashion when the war ended. So, you know, it went through the whole cycle sort of rather turned, came around again in the 1950s.
Earlier, you mentioned the girl as the person who Vreeland aspired to be. But was this also how she imagined her readers?
Yes, I think it was exactly. Absolutely, I think she was very rarely explicit about this. At least, not right up until the 1960s, when she became editor in chief of Vogue. This was how she saw. I think she was, it's quite difficult to explain, but she was always, right through her life, fundamentally, I think, aligned with the woman reading the magazine, the reader, not the fashion industry. And she always saw the reader as the author, as having this potential to be the kind of heroine of her own life, as the person who could make choices in a world of creative possibilities. And this was the best way of interesting the reader in fashion, to see her in this way, allow her to see herself in this way, capable of making these choices for herself and doing small stylish things that were enormously life enhancing, but they were absolutely within her reach, if only she just allowed her imagination a little bit of free reign. So yes, I think this concept of the girl was sort of fundamental to that. Any any reader could have her own sort of vision of the girl, and it was open to all readers.
So how did she wind up at Vogue, and what was her time like while she was there?
Well, her reasons for going from Harper's Bazaar after a very long stint to Vogue were fairly... Well, I think there had been a change of editor. Carmel Snow was forced to retire. She was replaced by her niece, who took the magazine in a much more... Well, I think Deanna Vreeland and other people felt she took it in a much more prosaic direction. I'm not sure it was that they were being entirely fair, but it was a different relationship. She stayed on for four years, but the real point of contention was money. I mean, the Hearst executives simply refused to give her to pay her properly and give her a proper pay rise. So when the top brass of Condé Nast made her an offer, which involved much more money and trips to Europe to go to the collections and all sorts of things, she jumped ship. She didn't become editor-in-chief of Vogue immediately. She had the best part of a year as an associate editor working alongside the editor-in-chief. And it wasn't absolutely clear that she would take over. But in the end, she did. They needed somebody to re-energize Vogue, and she was definitely the person at that time to do it. Vogue itself was... Actually, it had a much bigger circulation than Harper's Bazaar always, but it was a much more conservative magazine. It was addressed, it knew its business, it had been around since 1909, it had foreign editions. It was delivering advertisers to a really pretty conservative North American readership. And it wasn't really at all innovative when Deanna Vreeland took over. It's also important to understand that she took over as editor-in-chief in 1963, and really the 60s, as we think of them, didn't get going, and they certainly didn't reach upper-class America till a little bit later, till about sort of 1965, 1966. But what was really interesting for a biographer looking at 60s, Deanna's Vogues of the 1960s, is the extent to which she... Given this freedom of being editor-in-chief, no longer having to report upwards to anyone, she started to explore issues that went right back to her childhood, or certainly to her teenage years. So we see her, first of all, quite quickly, in the early 1960s, starting to introduce the idea that ugly women could be beauties, or women with funny faces like Barbara Streisand could be beauties too. So that's, one thing that a real preoccupation from her early years coming through. And we also see on the very first editorial in 1963, essentially introduce this person, the girl. She starts her first editorial in 1963 with a photograph, a very young American a socialite, though I think she went on to do other things, called Lily Cushing. And there's an editorial about how the most important thing is to listen to your own voice, to be yourself, to allow yourself to dream, and that way you can become the heroine of your own life. So that's very much the Deanna Vreeland we sort of see from those diary entries too. And I think it was that sort of access to her deep past that made it very easy for her, even though she was by then in her 60s, to embrace what she called, it was her expression, the youth quake. All these things, this rise that was just happening in front of everybody's eyes of the young as an independent style force, with the lead being taken by a group of stylish young people in from all walks of life in London. And she just thought this was great. One of the things one sees in her diary when she was much younger is a tremendous, tremendous frustration at how long she would have to wait before she could go out and be herself and start life. And she just loved the idea that these creatures of the youth quake no longer had to sit around waiting for life to start. And she could just understood it. She understood the release and the liberation that went with the tumbling of these barriers, and she really kept kept talking about it in the pages of Vogue and sort of making it acceptable, an acceptable idea to a fairly conservative readership. And as the 60s progressed, one can see this idea of, you know, you become that, you are the heroine of your own life, you are the creative force in a world of possibilities, you know, it's your decision, you pick, you choose, you do what you want with this idea, you go off and run with it, coming up again and again in the pages of Vogue. And it kind of reached it reached a sort of peak in about 1968, when she actually sent the model Verushka and the designer Giorgio De Sant'Angelo out into the painted desert with bolts of cloth and just sort of encouraged them to make the clothes up on the spot. And so that was really kind of taking it to, you know, in a very sort of famous series of images of Verushka wrapped up in a as a parcel with her head in a kind of huge huge headdress of fur and jersey. So that was kind of taking that idea to the furthest extreme in the same summer that Balenciaga finally shut his atelier, saying there was no one left to dress. So she really, really created an extraordinary magazine at that period, running with these ideas, allowing the photographers, encouraging the photographers to go off and create these extraordinary sort of personal fantasies with the with these models at the center of them.
How did Vreeland's Vogue respond to the anti-fashion feminism of the time?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I mean, obviously, feminism had been on the move. I mean, Betty Friedan had published The Feminine Mystique in 1963. By 1970, the 60s, obviously a very violent and turbulent period in all kinds of ways. But anyway, there was a, you know, in 1970, there was a sort of sharp reaction on all kinds of fronts, including, you know, a very well articulated argument by feminism that, you know, this that women should not go on just simply allowing themselves to be identified by how they presented themselves. You know, there were all sorts of other options open to women, and a life where you spent your whole time sort of dressing up and in these costumes, you know, wasn't the only option, and that there was something actually rather fundamentally very wrong with it. Well, this at this point, Diana Vreeland lost touch with the mood of the time. Really, for the first time in her career, she really couldn't get to grips with this at all. I mean, there's a famous story where a feminist said to her, this is obviously a highly abbreviated version of what happened, but a feminist said to her, Mrs. Vreeland, we do not wish to be, I do not wish to be any man's plaything. And DV looked at her and said, well, in that case, my dear, you have nothing to worry about. I think what she didn't understand was that the feminist objections were getting some traction with elite women who were readers of Vogue. Maybe not the mothers, but certainly younger women who were reading Vogue, who'd been to college, who'd had exposure to much more radical ideas, but were also beginning to embark on careers as doctors and lawyers and so on, and they wanted clothes for a different sort of life. You know, you really couldn't go out to work as a lawyer or a doctor tricked out as a jersey and all on parcel, like. It was a different mood, which gained the upper hand for a while. Of course, we now know that there's all sorts of ways of we're used to a much more eclectic sort of world now, where you could follow your own track in any of these directions. But anyway, this feminism definitely got a hold of the anti-fashion argument, and around 1970, this very, you know, extraordinary magazine lost touch with its readership, and as the readers disappeared, the advertisers revolted, and one thing led to another, and Condé Nast decided it simply couldn't go on, and they sacked her. I mean, they kicked her upstairs, and there was a formula was arrived at, but to all intents and purposes, she was sacked.
Mm-hmm. Vreeland is real. This part is what's really fascinating to me, because she had an extraordinary second act at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. Can you discuss the circumstances of how she got this position and what she was able to do whilst there?
Well, absolutely. After she was sacked, she had a very, very unhappy period, a sort of interregnum, which went on for about 18 months, while she cast around for something to do. I mean, she'd worked since 1933. She found the lack of structure, everything terribly difficult. She tried a bit of this, she tried a bit of consulting. She did work for, this, that, and the next thing. And she had this sort of kind of notional position in Vogue, as well. And they were actually, Condé Nast very generous to her. The suggestion that she should become a special consultant for the Costume Institute at the Met was floated during this period, but she didn't respond terribly favourably. She said she had nothing, she knew nothing about museums, she really wasn't interested in the past. It was what was happening now that really, really interested in her. She'd only ever been into museums as a tourist, so they kept making the argument. Then she got ill, and she was in hospital for several weeks, and all sorts of people came to visit her. And I think several friends who were connected with both the Costume Institute and knew her very well talked her into giving it a go. I think understanding in a way that she didn't understand what she could bring to this role, and that somehow she really ought to give it, should try and make it work. So she decided to, and immediately or very quickly she began. She didn't really understand what she was taking on. I mean, all the correspondence, she really had to jump in, and she worked terribly, terribly hard. But she also began to see quite quickly that, though she wasn't a scholar, she could bring all sorts of experience to this world of presenting costume exhibitions to the general public that no scholar could bring. So, and there were great challenges, and it allowed her to a completely different sort of canvas. So, in essence, one of the things that happened was that she was working in three dimensions for the first time. So she introduced the idea of playing, music during the exhibitions on a tape. She appealed to the visitor's sense of smell. She had the gallery sprayed with perfume three times a day. And she also had the clothes lit like a fashion editor. So they were, the lighting was far more subtle. There were beautiful coloured backgrounds creating atmosphere. She found little touches to accessorize the exhibitions that kind of opened up a historical idea. She really locked horns with some of the more scholarly academics in the museum in the process, because what she was really interested in still came back to this idea of what was in the mind of the woman who was or the man or the girl who was wearing the clothes. Why did they make these choices? Why did this idea catch on? What was in their minds? What were they imagining? So this idea of a kind of a woman's inner world actually informed the exhibitions too. And they, beautifully lit with wonderful music and smelling divine. It was absolutely revolutionary in the first four or five exhibitions, and the crowds just poured in.
What is your favourite story about Diana Vreeland?
My favourite story? Oh, I've got so many. My favourite story about Diana Vreeland. Well, I don't know. Out of all the kind of enormous number of stories about Diana Vreeland, I really got a favourite. But I guess what surprised me about Diana Vreeland was how uplifting her story was, because she really believed that if you dream something into existence and insisted on making it happen, it would happen. And it did for her, you know. So she actually believed, to put it in its most sort of banal, that dreams can come true. And because, and as a biographer, you know, I had to accept that in her case, they certainly did. No? That's what surprised me. That's, in a sense, what I liked best about working on the book. It was very cheering.
What do you see as her legacy?
Sorry, could you repeat that one? That was muffled.
What do you see as her legacy?
What do I see as her legacy? Well, first of all, she definitely did change the way costume exhibitions are done. I don't think there's any argument about that. I mean, they had their flaws, they had their critics, but there she was definitely a game changer. When it came to fashion, I think what she definitely did do was extend the vocabulary of fashion by insisting on the authority of the imagination. You know, this idea that, you know, the imaginative world has a huge role to play in the wearing and the designing of clothes is an idea that's really come from her. And so I think she definitely extended the vocabulary of fashion. So that's an important legacy. I think more generally, it's always difficult to tell whether somebody's always reporting or create, you know, someone, particularly a journalist, is, or the world of journalism, is reporting on what they see or actually helping to make the cultural weather. But I think to some extent, Deanna Vreeland was very important in the 1960s, introducing this idea that you, the reader, could be this creative force at the centre of your life. It was you. You didn't have to copy other people. There wasn't, you know, you shouldn't be too intimidated by a set appropriate way of dressing or doing things. You know, you should use your imagination, and, you know, you're an individual. There's this great process of, you know, individualization going on around you. You know, and it was for the good. It was a positive thing. So I think she had a wider cultural influence there too, which was very important.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us today about Deanna Vreeland and Bristol Fashion. Any idea who you'll be writing about next?
No, not at the moment. I'm having a little breather. I'm talking about Deanna Vreeland quite a lot to people, and I think there was one person lurking in Deanna Vreeland's story whose life I want to investigate further to see if it's as interesting as I think it is, but I can't say who that is at the moment. She's in there, she's in the book, but at the moment it's a secret. I need to find out more.
Now everyone can read the book and try to figure out who it is. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure.
I've been talking today with Amanda Mackenzie Stewart about Deanna Vreeland and Brissa Fashion. I'm Oline Eaton. This is New Books and Biography. Thanks for listening.